Dave Tasho will be on case 32 in the Mumon Kong, the Gate of No Barrier. A non-Buddhist philosopher questions the Buddha. A non-Buddhist philosopher said to the Buddha, "I do not ask for words, I do not ask for non-words." The Buddha just sat there. The philosopher said admiringly, "The world-honored one, with his great compassion, has blown away the clouds of my illusion and enabled me to enter the way." After making bows, he took his leave. Then Ananda asked the Buddha, "What did he realize to admire you so much?" The world-honored one replies, "A fine horse runs even at the shadow of the whip." Mumon's comment: Ananda was the Buddha's disciple, but his understanding was not equal to that of the non-Buddhist. I want to ask you, what difference is there between the Buddha's disciple and the non-Buddhist? Mumon's verse: on the edge of a sword, over the river of an iceberg, with no steps, no ladders, climbing the cliff without hands. So let's imagine this scene. A non-Buddhist philosopher said to the Buddha, such and such. Perhaps it was like this. Perhaps people had assembled at Vulture Peak, where Siddhartha Gautama would deliver his teachings. It was customary for him to go with an entourage of men and women up to Vulture Peak and deliver some of the texts we know as sermons. And on those occasions and on other occasions, people would ask Siddhartha Gautama questions about the cultivation of the way of life he taught, and he would respond to those questions. One of the interesting things about this koan is that the person who poses the question is not a so-called Buddhist. So perhaps you're in the entourage, you're a Buddhist, you're a monk, you're a nun, or you're a lay man or a lay woman, follower of the Buddha. And you go up to the top of Vulture Peak, and the Buddha delivers his teaching, and then somebody stands up who isn't wearing saffron or isn't wearing white, has a different kind of, maybe it has a hair pulled up in a knot instead of a shaved head, maybe has some of the accoutrements of a sadhu, a wandering Hindu holy man, and approaches the Buddha and poses a question to the Buddha. So this is such an interesting scene because it raises so many issues that are important, I think, for all of us. In a certain sense, this koan is about encountering Buddha encountering a non-Buddhist. In other words, one of us encountering one who is not one of us. So you could put this in a little different way, and the message would be the same. Maybe it would be, I myself, for example, politically, have always admired FDR. I think of FDR, Franklin Roosevelt, as one of the great American political leaders. And I must say that whenever I think about Roosevelt, I actually get a little teary-eyed, you know, because I admire him so much. So this would be a little bit like Franklin Delano Roosevelt is questioned by Ronald Reagan, let's say. Okay. In other words, I'm a Roosevelt fan, and Ronald Reagan was not one of us. Okay. Well, we could go on and on. This could be like an Israeli is questioned by an Arab. You know, you don't have to go very far to see what's in play here. You know, we create this thing called identity. We create individual identities, and we create collective identities. And these are extremely useful, very helpful in all kinds of ways. So, you know, when Siddhartha Gautama had his great awakening experience, he began to help other people by teaching them the way to that same experience. And at some point it became necessary for people practicing his path to organize themselves in a certain way. The Buddha himself outlined a way of life which involved living with very few material objects, not cultivating certain kind of appearance, but dressing very simply, having, if you were a monk or a nun, having no personal possessions. And all of these were expedient means designed to help people pursue awakening. It's interesting that the Buddha defined awakening as the experience of a reality beyond identity. When Siddhartha Gautama had his great awakening experience, he actually didn't say, "I'm the Buddha. I've done it. I'm the Buddha." Actually, what he experienced was a disappearance of identity. And a complete sense of connection with everything around him. And the path he laid out for people was designed to help them have this experience. So the idea was that if you became a monk or a nun, you would get rid of that closet full of clothes, and you would just have a simple robe that you wore, actually just one piece of cloth that you would arrange around your body modestly. You would have a begging bowl, and people would give you food because you wouldn't have any personal property. You would shave your head so that you wouldn't be concerned about your appearance. You didn't have to worry about that. And actually, you would give up your name and take a new name that was not really like a personal family name or a given name, but just a sort of functional name that might describe some aspect of the experience you were aiming for. So, interestingly, the Buddha himself had an experience beyond identity, or so he said, and all of his disciples, lay and monastic, were pursuing this experience beyond identity. But you know, even all of those people created an identity, created a self, Buddhist. This is quite an important aspect of human life, because we do this all the time, even when we don't want to. this koan involves an encounter between people in the Buddhist community, including Siddhartha Gautama, and a non-Buddhist. non-Buddhist. And the non-Buddhist is a really important detail because this is like the stranger in our midst, right? The stranger in our midst, not one of us. And to make it even worse, he's a philosopher, right? You know, now, I don't know if you read the student paper, but yesterday there was an article on the retirement, or I'm sorry, a very famous philosopher in our department was leaving Rutgers. He's a top philosopher, really one of the best in the country. And he's leaving Rutgers and he's going down to the University of Miami in Florida. And the whole university has been rocked by this news. And the article was very, it caught my eye because I myself am somewhat nervous around members of the philosophy department. Now, over in English, we read philosophy, but people in the philosophy department think we're a bunch of sissies, you know. Because we read a little philosophy, and we read a little poetry, and we read a little fiction, and we come up with something that we think is interesting and nice, you know. And we present our ideas to each other, and maybe we criticize them a little bit, and maybe we don't. Yeah. And then we all go and have lunch. Right? But those philosophers aren't like that. You know, not at all. They're not nice guys over there. They're mean, and they're tough, and they make you cry. But they are. They're tough over there, you know. They're analytic, the worst kind of philosophers. They're analytic philosophers. You know, over in English, we're sort of like hermeneutic philosophers. So we're very generous and kind. But over there, they're tough and mean, you know. So those philosophers, they're tough. So it's not just a... not just an interloper, not just a stranger in our midst, but a philosopher. So to get back to the Targum article, this professor was not retiring, he was leaving Rutgers, and he was going down to Florida, and he's really one of the most distinguished philosophers on how the mind works. Colin McGinn is his name, and I admire his work greatly. It's very tough-minded, very exacting, and very interesting. And what he said in the paper I found so interesting also, because he said, I'm leaving Rutgers because I want to go to Florida. I love water sports. So he said, I'm leaving a top department, but really I'm just going because I like to play in the water. I thought, great! You know, that's fantastic. You know, we're brothers after all. You know, it was a big relief to see that we had this in common. I'm not very good at water sports, but I too like to splash around in the water. And I was relieved also that philosophers have this other side. So this is an encounter between a stranger in our midst, who happens to be a formidable, maybe formidable, possibly formidable adversary, and the Buddha. So if you can imagine the scene, everybody's sitting on Vulture Peak. We're all members of the Sangha. We're all members of the community. We all share the same values. We all share the same identity. We're Buddhists. And then maybe this sannyasin, this strange rishi, stands up and walks up to the Buddha. And, you know, maybe you're sitting there thinking, you know, what's going to happen? You know, is he going to challenge the Buddha? Is he going to argue with the Buddha? And maybe, you know, you have in your mind a kind of anxiety at a scene like this, because you think to yourself, well, I know the Buddha will be able to defeat any argument that comes his way, because he's the Buddha. There's a part of you that thinks, but what if he doesn't? Wouldn't that be a bad day? You know, what if this terrible philosopher in our midst know, tore down the thing we value the most. What if he humiliates the Buddha? What if he dethrones this Buddha, who we said was enlightened? So, you know, the stakes are rather high in this encounter, which is happening right here in public for all to see. And perhaps people get nervous, you know, about it. And you might wonder how the Buddha, what's going on in the Buddha's head, you know, because he's coming to deliver a talk, and he assumes he's going to be among friends, yeah? And he's not going to have to defend his basic assumptions and practices. And then this strange man, we assume, stands up. We don't really know what gender, but stands up and approaches. And you know, maybe the Buddha goes, gulp, you know. You know, these are all my students. What if I have an argument with this guy and I, you know, don't win? Could look bad. So this is really like an interesting, very interesting scene, I think. Because we all have our non-Buddhist philosopher. I mean, I said a little earlier that the non-Buddhist philosopher, you know, this could be FDR and Ronald Reagan. This could be, Ben-Gurion and Arafat. Right? This could be Jesus and Muhammad, or Muhammad and Jesus. You know, you take in reverse positions. But you see what this is about. It doesn't have to be about an encounter between people. Now, this is the end of the semester, and might also be an encounter between yourself and an event, like a big exam, right? So you're being questioned by non-Buddhist philosopher. Maybe that's your calculus professor, you know? Or maybe that's your you're going for your PhD, and that's your examining committee, right? Your qualifying committee, and they're going to ask you about your genre and. You say gulp. I love this koan because we practice Zen, and we talk about a no self. If you study Buddhist philosophy, you know there's this doctrine of no self, getting beyond the self. We talk about small self and big mind all the time. People can define themselves as a Buddhist, or as a Hindu, or as Christian. And we create these identities to help us live, and help us live a fuller life. And so in that sense, they're really important, really positive. But there's a kind of a danger inherent in identity also, isn't there? Or isn't there? When you're growing up, it's convenient to be a self. It's convenient to have a self. And if you think about what an identity is, it becomes really interesting. I think identity really starts with having a body, having an actual body. And this is something people don't like to think about. You know, when we talk about ourself, we don't like to think about the fact that it all begins maybe with having a body. I had this come home to me in a really powerful way this last weekend, a week ago. Some of you know from you know, conversations with me, or I might have mentioned it in a previous Taisho, that about a year ago, my mother, who's about 80 years old, she's 79 actually, began to exhibit a very strange sort of emotional or mental unbalance. And we thought maybe she was beginning to have Alzheimer's disease or senile dementia, but it just turned out that her thyroid medicine had not been appropriately adjusted, and what seemed like a mental illness was actually just caused by the thyroid medicine being out of whack. And this last weekend, again, last week on Friday night, my brother called me and said, mother called her and said there had been a break-in in her apartment. And she said some boys from the college had broken into her apartment. So my brother rushed over, and there was no evidence of a break-in. And my mother was convinced that these college kids down the hall had broken into her apartment and had taken things. And she was very disoriented. So this, her disorientation became worse over the weekend, and my brother and my sister took her up to a hospital in Richmond, Virginia. And they were really, truly fearful that she had lost her mind. And, you know, they were saying, my brother said, I've never seen anything like it. You know, maybe she's had a stroke. They did all these x-rays. And it turned out that, believe it or not, my mother had a, she'll probably kill me for telling you this. She had a urinary tract infection. And when you're 80 years old, if you get a urinary tract infection, your kidneys can't handle it. And the toxins build up in your bloodstream, and they build up in your brain, and you become deranged. I just thought that was, I mean, it's my mother. I was very worried and very distressed, but when the news came that all she had to do was take Cipro and that she was getting better, I began to reflect on this. And I thought, that's amazing. You know, we think of ourselves in such abstract terms, but identity all comes back to having a body, doesn't it? If we didn't have a body, we wouldn't really have a self. And who we are is really tied in very intimately with this body we have. And part of growing up, part of becoming an identity or having an identity is learning how to inhabit our bodies, and deal with all of these conflicting forces in our bodies. You know, we have all of these drives and energy flows and all of these impulses, and it's like a riot or a chaos. And part of what we have to do as we grow up is learn how to tame or how to manage or how to weave all of these energies together into some kind of a harmonious whole. And I think having an identity is connected to this project of sort of like managing all these energies. Just living in a body is very complicated. And a lot of the time we're just holding on, you know, just barely holding on. People find themselves suddenly overwhelmed by anxiety or nag, you know, unable to sleep because of something that's happened to them. Well, this is like this instability, basic instability at the heart of the self. So I think we work very hard to create a kind of personality we can cling to and hold on to and inhabit our bodies in a dependable and stable way. And it works pretty well, I think, some of the time. But actually, as we're growing up, it becomes rather complicated for reasons I think we should pay attention to. You know, everybody has an idea about how we should live. And this is a good thing and a bad thing. I've talked about this before, but as you're growing up, you begin to get instructions from people who have gone before you, and so your mother says to you one day, you can't wear jeans anymore. You're a little girl. You have to start wearing a dress. or your father says to you, you know, I don't want you to play with those little girls, I want you to go out and play with the boys and play football. We learn how to inhabit these roles that our parents or our authorities in our lives give us. This is good in a certain way because it helps us to maintain that stability I'm talking about. You know, that the body has all of these drives, all of these forces that are somewhat contradictory, and it takes about 18 years to learn how to keep them in balance, and then they fall out of balance, you know, not just for chemical reasons, but just because of things that happen to us. And so, you know, part of the equipment we pick up as we're growing older are these masks or these roles we learn to play, and they're given to us by our parents. And, we can get quite skillful at maintaining these masks or maintaining these roles and maintaining that balance, that precious balance. But probably everybody in the room understands that at some point that's not necessarily a satisfactory way to live. It might be that your life just becomes too balanced, too calm and too steady, and you begin to feel that something's really missing. Or you might have noticed that you can't seem to get real balance in your life because you've gotten these conflicting instructions. You know, so my father, for example, really loved me, and when he was trying to help me out when I was a little boy, he would give me these long lectures. My brother and I would see my father sitting in the living room, and when he came home from work sometimes, he liked to have a martini. I don't know if your father was like this, but my father really liked martinis. And my brother and I would come in and see Dad sitting on the sofa having his martini, and we would try to become invisible so we didn't get to be the object of one of his lectures. But my father was a very hardworking man, and he would come back from the military base where he lived, or later from the Pentagon. He actually worked at the Pentagon or near the Pentagon. And he would be drinking his martinis, and he would tell me that I had to be a competitive person. He was worried because I wasn't competitive enough. So he would say, Kurt, you know, you've got to be a fighter in this world. He actually used to say that to me. And I think it was because that was the lesson he was getting on his job, that, you know, he worked in the government or in the military, very competitive, maybe not very cooperative environment. And he would say, you've got to be a fighter. You've got to be a fighter in this world. You know, I was just trying to get out of the room, but it sunk in, you know, sunk in a little bit. Later, when I went to college, you know, I decided to major in English. And I was very worried about telling my father that I was going to be an English major, because I thought he would really give me a hard time over that. And, I thought his idea was that I should become maybe an engineer or a scientist or something like that. And I came back from my first year of college, and I told my father I was going to major in English, and I was just waiting for him to get upset. And instead he said, oh, that's good. He said, you know, everybody's got to, you know, something like, do his own thing, or, you know, everybody has to walk his own road, or something like that. And I was just astonished, because it was so contradictory. You know, it was so much unlike the lessons he had given me before. And even then, I wasn't very sharp in those days, I think, but even then it occurred to me that, you know, my father had been giving me all of these conflicting instructions all the time. And even though he loved me, it really made it hard for me to know what to do. And so a lot of my college life was spent in a kind of absolute confusion. You know, like all of these, some people said do this, some people said do that. You know, I don't know, you probably, most of you probably weren't even born when I was in college, but this was the end of the 70s, the end of the 60s, and the early 70s. And so the campus was full of people who were, the slogan used to be, tune in, turn on, and drop out. That was the slogan. So all these people were going back to their dorm rooms and they had big bongs full of marijuana, you know. And they wore beautiful clothes, you know, they had these beautiful jeans with these beautiful patches sewn on them, and they, you know, my friends were only too ready to let me have a toke on their bong, you know. And indeed, I had a few tokes. And I had a set of friends who would actually just laugh. They'd say, you know, job, who cares about jobs? You know, we're just going to toke our bongs and have a good life, you know. Go back to the land. That was the idea. Well, when we get out of college, we're going to go back to the land. Okay. And then I had, you know, friends who were like a business types, and they already had suits. They already went around the campus in their suits and briefcases. You know, they were like, I had the people in the hippie clothes, and I had the friends who were in the business world. And then I had my friends who were like scientists, and they had, this was in the days when they still used to have like rubber pen guards in their pockets for all their pens and everything. And that people still used to use slide rolls back then, right? So I had all these different sets of friends, and they all had very different sets of values, and I sometimes felt like I was being torn apart by all of these different messages I was getting. And I don't know if this happens to you sometimes, but I would get really depressed, you know? I mean, I would find myself like, I don't know if depressed is the word, but I would just feel like I was floating on an ocean with no shores in sight. You know, I just felt totally lost. I had no energy sometimes, you know. And I just felt torn apart by these contradictions. So it was really, it would have been really great if I could have just, you know, like signed up with the college Republicans. There weren't very many in those days. You know, and be said, I'm a Republican, you know. Or actually, there weren't any Buddhists on campus, but you know, I could have gone to maybe some religious organization and become a this or a that. And it would have been so reassuring, but I couldn't seem to find an identity that really was appropriate. You know, then I began, many years later, to sit with Genki Roshi. And you know, at some point, I felt like I really had the life that I wanted. And I really began to think, you know, I'm a Buddhist. I am a Buddhist. So identity is a really interesting thing, because human beings are complex, and they're pulled in, their biology, I think, makes them rather unstable. And then culture pulls us in all these different directions, and we sort of latch on to an identity, a self, a stable place where we can rest and be safe, come back to every day, know this is our like safe haven. You know, it doesn't have to be religious identity. It can be political identity. I'm a Democrat. You know, I'm a leftist. I'm a conservative. You know. And people embrace these with such a zest and such a sense of relief. But, you know, beware, right? A non-Buddhist philosopher said to the Buddhist, you know, said to the Buddha, comes up to the Buddha. What does he do? Does he challenge him? Is this a challenge? What is this? He says, I did not ask for words. I did not ask for non-words. The Buddha just sat there. It's like, what's this all about? My feeling is that the encounter with the non-Buddhist is the most wonderful opportunity in the world. The most wonderful opportunity. And really, there's nothing like it. Nothing, I think, in this whole world like that opportunity. You know, this is, in one sense, about, you know, like ecumenism, this koan. You know, if you're a Buddhist and you encounter somebody whose beliefs are very different from yours, you know, this is can be frightening, destabilizing. You know, how are you supposed to deal with that, right? Somebody, maybe you meet somebody who thinks you're going to hell, as a matter of fact. You know, in my own family, I have people who very much disapprove of my life. And they haven't told me I'm going to hell, but I actually think they believe I am. So, you know, it's a challenge, right? Dealing with this. And it's very tempting, right, to say, you and I are totally separate. You're you and I'm me. But that's very crippling, as a matter of fact. Very crippling response. And it's a powerful response because, as I said, you know, the human body is somewhat unstable, and we have all these conflicting messages, and as we're growing up, we grab onto something like a port in the storm, and we hold on for dear life. You know, maybe it's not a religious belief, maybe it's a political philosophy, maybe it's just you hold on to being a scientist, or you hold on to being smart, or you hold on to being attractive, or you hold on to being witty. But you know, sooner or later, something is going to push that button and threaten that safe harbor, right? And then what are you going to do? So this koan is just pointing to this wonderful opportunity. And we see the Buddha doing something, but it's not exactly clear what he does. Now, let me say that this is not just about encounters with people, but it can be about encounters with events. In fact, it can even be about your relationship with your koan, right? Because the koan, too, is like a stranger in your midst that's profoundly threatening, you know, actually. You know, when you do a little zazen for a few years, you get very good at sitting. You can sit for a few hours, and you can watch your breath, and you can enter samadhi. And you might begin to think, you know, I'm really becoming a man of Zen. And I'm really becoming a woman of Zen. And then the teacher gives you this vile koan, right? What is the sound of one hand clapping? And it's very threatening, isn't it? You know, very, because I really thought I was a man of Zen. And now I'm sitting on the cushion, and everything I am is threatened by this encounter with this stranger in my midst. Now, how are we supposed to greet the stranger in our midst? And this is just so important, because every fiber of our being may say, you know, cast him out. You know, cast him, get him out of here. He is not us. You know, you are not me. And of course, the element of hate is very powerful because the element of fear is so powerful, right? And this can even happen with the koan practice, with the koan practice. You know, I have occasionally had people who I've met here in the Zendo, beginners who come to sit with us, and at the end of the period, they're actually mad. You know, they're actually angry. This is actually, you know, they don't necessarily show it to anybody besides me, but you know, I can see in their eyes like real anger, like how dare you do this to me, you know. And so this kind, you know, practice itself takes them to the edge of this safe place, and makes them sit face to face with the stranger among us. So you know, how are we supposed to deal with that? And, you know, the encounter here is so important. A non-Buddhist philosopher said to the Buddha, I do not ask for words, I do not ask for non-words. You know, one way to see this as like a, he set a trap, or a challenge for our beloved Buddha. And will he get out of it? Will he win? Or will he lose? The Buddha just sat there. The philosopher said admiringly, the world-honored one with his great mercy has blown away the clouds of my illusion and enabled me to enter the way. So the koan is, what did the Buddha do? What did the Buddha do? It doesn't tell you, which is why it's such a good koan. But we all have to face this moment, and the more we face it, I believe, the better, the happier, the richer, the fuller our lives are. Because, you know, human beings create order by exclusion. We create stability by exclusion. We create safety by exclusion. And this is like very dangerous, because it constantly recapitulates or constantly recreates this fundamental split. Me, not me. Us, not us. And this is very dangerous. This is like where all of this violence and unhappiness come from. You know, it's possible in meditation practice to go a very long way without overcoming this sense of basic distrust, basic separation. I'm a Buddhist, you're a Hindu, you know. And it persists for a very long time. It's a very, very dangerous situation. You know, people can cultivate very advanced states of awareness which still allow them to maintain a certain sense of identity, certain sense of separation from something outside themselves. You know, when you're working with your koan, you know, there's fear. What's really happening is you can't get to the koan because your fear is preventing you. This is really what's the problem. You know, we're working with a koan, and it's too threatening to our identity, actually, some aspect of our identity. And sometimes we're sitting on the cushion and we suddenly realize, you know what, I'm afraid. My God, I'm afraid. You know, it's basically I am unable to trust, right? Basically, I'm unable to trust. My feeling is we have to keep encountering the stranger in our midst until that distrust goes away, no matter how long it takes. No matter how long it takes, we have to keep encountering that stranger in our midst. Whatever it is, whoever it is, whatever it is. I was driving into school yesterday, and I was listening to NPR, and Sarah Jessica Parker came on. I don't know if you like Sarah Jessica Parker, but I do. And she was promoting NPR. And they were talking to her about this new role she had taken, and she had such a good spirit, because she said, you know, I just come from my television show, and then they asked me to do this show. I guess it's a Broadway show. And they said, well, how did you feel about that? She said, it terrified me. She said, because I've been in TV all this time. You know, you do a scene, and if you don't get it right, they cut, and they redo the scene. She said, you know, I'm going to be up in front of the public, and if you make a mistake, everybody can see it. There's no array. You can't cut and redo it. And they said, how did you feel? She said, oh, I was terrified. And she said, that's why I had to do it. I just thought, yes, you know, that's it. You know, she said, and she said something like, you know, I feel that if when I come up against something and I think there's no way I can do this, she said, I know I definitely have to do it. I just thought, oh, I don't know if she sits, but I'll bet she sits. You know? I'll bet she's one of us. Maybe not. But she's got it, you know, she's got it. And that's the you sit with your koan. You sit with your koan. And, you know, you hate this damn koan, you know. Hakuin Zenji called them those vile koans, you know. Nobody wants to have their identity attacked by a koan. But, somehow when we get outside of ourselves, it's like a breath of fresh air. We're not so safe. You know, we're not so protected. But life is bigger. And we feel more alive. And actually more stability, you know, more joy, more happiness. Oddly, we need these structures, but ultimately, you know, they become our prison house. We need these identities, but ultimately, they, you know, we don't have to look very far to see it. You know, all of, you're a Muslim, I'm a such and such, you know, let's, you know, the terror. Absolute terror, absolute aggression, you know. But it doesn't have to be those. You're a deconstructionist, and I'm a, you know, something else. I'm a hermeneuticist or something. You know, people can find reasons to be terrified of one another all the time. You know, and even in religion, you know, this actually, because religion is connected to, in such a fundamental way, to our identity, to the way we organize our bodily energies and our relationships to other people. Religion is especially fraught with this as a problem. You know, I was just reading this sociologist, and he's written on religion, and he's also like a theologian, and he's so interesting because he was saying, basically, he was looking at world religions, and he said, you know, the interesting problem with world religions is that they all have quite a bit of violence written right into their central traditions. This is a man of great courage. He's actually a Lutheran, but I admire his candor so much. He said, you know, in the Bible, there's quite a bit of violence that's divinely authorized, right? And he said, in the Quran, same thing. In the Gita, same thing. Now, it's not as though this is incidental. Central. So, you know, religion especially is the place where these threats become most violently experienced. And where that aggressive response becomes most violently manifested. So religion is especially problematic, especially can be a prison house. So very important, I think, to come face to face with the stranger in our midst all the time, over and over again, whatever it is. Easy to say, of course, hard to do. A non-Buddhist philosopher said to the Buddha, I do not ask for words, I do not ask for non-words. The Buddha just sat there. My understanding of this path is that awakening means the disappearance of a sense of separation. So if you wonder, am I fully awake yet? You know, as soon as that sense of separation arises, you know, it's often accompanied by fear or anger, as soon as that separation arises, you know you're not there yet. And it may take many lifetimes, but such a wonderful practice, such a wonderful way to live. You know, my feeling is that ahimsa, non-violence, is right at the center of this practice. In other words, as soon as we create the enemy again, as soon as we have created the enemy again with our minds, as soon as we have created the stranger again with our minds, we're a million miles from it, a million miles from awakening, a million miles from God, a million miles from Allah. Million miles from Ram. so unnecessary. So we have to, our practice always lies with the stranger, and he's our greatest friend, right? The non-Buddhist philosopher is our greatest friend. And this could be a person, can be an event, can be our koan, whatever. It can be a book. All the time, that sense of impossible. This is not me. This is where awakening lies. This is where enlightenment lies, in that encounter. A non-Buddhist philosopher said to the Buddha, I do not ask for words, I do not ask for non-words. The Buddha just sat there. The philosopher said admiringly, the world-honored one, in other words, the Buddha, with his great compassion, has blown away the clouds of my illusion and enabled me to enter the way. After making vows, he took his leave. Then Ananda asked, Ananda, see, is not awake. Ananda lives, at this point in his practice, Ananda, the Buddha's cousin, was basically a very intelligent person, really supposed to be luminously intelligent, but had not had a great awakening experience. So then Ananda said to the Buddha, what did he realize to admire you so much? And the Buddha said, a fine horse runs even at the shadow of the whip. That line is a little disturbing until you understand that the Buddha was trained, belonged to the Chetri group, you could say. His family were soldiers, actually, like the warriors, and received a training in archery, horse riding, swordsmanship, all of this he gave up. He's talking about how a good horse never has to be struck. He'll gallop just if he sees you coming, he'll gallop properly. He'll gallop perfectly well. So what he's really saying here is that this non-Buddhist philosopher did not live in the realm of form, the realm of idea, or the realm of identity. So we could meet as brothers. We could meet as one. We are different in our personal circumstances, you know? But we're all the same in another deeper sense. As long as we cling to our personal circumstances, we remain in the realm of a conflict. But some people don't live in that realm. They enter Mushin. Mushin doesn't belong to any denomination or creed. It's the heritage of all living beings without exception, door to awakening. So this non-Buddhist philosopher also lives in Mushin. So it's like some horses don't need to see the whip. They don't need the words. They don't need the forms. They don't need the identity. He also lives beyond identity, see, is what he's saying. Mumon's comment. Ananda was the Buddha's disciple, but his understanding was not equal to that of the non-Buddhist, because he was trying to understand. Beyond understanding is something bigger. I want to ask you, what difference is there between the Buddha's disciple and the non-Buddhist? What's the difference between a Buddhist and a non-Buddhist? Free yourself. Free yourself. What's the difference between a Democrat and a Republican? Between FDR and Reagan? Between an Israeli and a Palestinian, Japanese and Chinese, man and woman. Mumon's verse, on the edge of a sword, over the ridge of an iceberg, with no steps, no ladders, no steps, no ladders, climbing the cliffs without hands. These are two people who travel with no step, climb with no steps and no ladders, climb with no hands. So let's all follow them.